Thank you for the special music, Jamie. And that was your own creation, your own composition. I'm impressed with anybody can do anything musical. So I'm very impressed with that. And Mr. Buchanan, for a minute there, I thought you were going to steal some of my thunder in my sermon today. There will be some similarities. We did not collude before or in preparing our messages. Some of you may remember portions of a sermonette that I gave a little over 8 years ago now. I titled it, When It Isn't Fair, We Must Still Forbear. Today I want to expand on that message, and some of you aren't there, and I'll start with an abbreviated recap. I told the story about a pitcher for the Detroit Tigers baseball team. His name was Armando Galarraga. In 2010, he came about as close as you could come to achieving the ultimate for a pitcher in a baseball game. He almost pitched a perfect game. Perfect game being when a pitcher manages to get out every player on the opposing team without walking anybody, without giving up any hits, without any of his teammates making an error, without letting anybody get to base. It's a remarkable achievement in over 140 years and hundreds of thousands of Major League Baseball games. Only 23 pitchers have ever accomplished this feat. And in 2010, Armando Galarraga was on the verge of joining them in baseball history. It's the ninth inning. He'd gotten the first two batters out, and then he got the third batter to hit a ground ball to the first baseman, who fielded it, and he tossed it to him as he covered first base in time to what should have been the third and final out of the game, except the umpire called him safe. And it was obvious that he should have been called out, and they showed it on the replays. By baseball standards, Armando Galarraga had been dealt a terrible injustice. But I pointed out how his response was an unusual example of forbearance. Instead of arguing and maybe kicking dirt at the umpire and some of the other things that baseball players tend to do in those kind of situations, he didn't say a word. He smiled sort of a disappointed smile, went back to the pitching mound, got back to business, and proceeded to get the next batter out and finish the game and win it for his team. He was poised. He showed self-control. He's tolerant. And he demonstrated a good-natured response to, I guess what you'd say, was incompetence. All of which fit into a definition of forbearance. I noted how it was a stark contrast to a very similar dramatic baseball situation that happened 25 years earlier. It was on the exact same type of play. At that time, the St. Louis Cardinals were on the brink of winning the 1985 World Series, when they also suffered an injustice at the hands of an umpire. It was the sixth game of the series against the Kansas City Royals. The Cardinals were leading the series 3-2. They just needed one more win. And they were leading in that what was hoping for them, the last game, by a score of 1-0. They'd made it to the ninth inning. They were only 3 outs away from the World Series championship, the World Series crown. And then it happened. Leadoff batter for the Royals hit ground ball to the Cardinals' first baseman. He scooped it up. He threw it to the pitcher who was covering first base for an apparent out, except that again, the umpire called him safe. And then they go to the replay, and yep, he should have been out. But in sharp contrast to Armando Galarraga, the Cardinals did all those bad things. They argued. They yelled. They screamed. They generally behaved like little boys were throwing a temper tantrum. And in the process, they lost their composure and began to fall apart as a team. After that bad call at first base, the next batter hit an easy pop fly in foul territory behind first base. But for some reason, none of the Cardinal players managed to catch it, even though two or three of them were right there and could have easily done so. So instead of getting the batter out, they gave him another chance, and he took advantage of it. He got a base hit. A few plays later, catcher for the Cardinals blundered. He committed a pass ball, which led to a walk, all of which helped the opposing team, the Royals, come from behind and win the game. Of course, the Cardinals still had another chance. All they had to do was come back and win the seventh and deciding game the next night. Unfortunately for them, they'd not recovered their composure. They were still bitter from the last game. And they didn't show any understanding of the word forbearance. In fact, the Cardinals demonstrated even less forbearance than they had in the previous game. They argued with the umpire. They whined about the calls, even when the calls were correct. They even argued among themselves. They discouraged each other. They lost their ability to work together as a team. Their manager got kicked out of the game. One of their pitchers got kicked out of the game. And the Cardinals were completely outclassed. They ended up losing the game 11-0. Very, very bitter defeat for them. Cardinals of 1985 and Armando Galarraga, 2010. Two identical wrong calls at first base, but two completely different reactions to that call. And it was interesting to note that while neither reaction, I mean, you're not going to change the umpire's mind by arguing. You can't change what's already happened. The response had no effect on what had already taken place. But their reactions did impact their future. It did impact the events that followed. Galarraga went on to win the game. No, he didn't achieve legendary status as having pitched a perfect game, although his classy behavior so impressed some of the Detroit executives of General Motors that they gave him a brand new car. The other hand, though, the Cardinals, they had a chance to win a World Series crown, but their bitter reaction caused them to lose that crown. How's that for a spiritual metaphor or analogy there? Of course, that's a huge lesson for us as Christians. When it isn't fair, we must still forbear. And like I said, I wanted to expand on that idea today. Turn to 1 Peter 2, verse 18. 1 Peter 2:18. We all know that the life isn't always fair in our world, in our society. There is not perfect justice. We're sometimes forced to suffer because of the incompetence, the mistakes, and the sins of other people. Even in the church, God's church is not perfect. God's people are not perfect. I have to remind myself sometime and prompt myself to be more forbearing by simply remembering some of the irritations that I've caused for other people simply because I've been forgetful or done dumb things at times. Yeah, John Jackson's very forgiving. I think in the last, I don't know, couple of years, I think I've only remembered once without his prompting to give him the title for the sermon and the synopsis. And yeah, he had to email me yesterday about this. Sorry, John. Thank you. You're very forbearing. 1 Peter 2, starting verse 18. Servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the harsh. For this is commendable, if because of conscience toward God, one endures grief, suffering wrongfully, when it's not fair. For what credit is it if you're beaten for your faults, when you deserve it, you take it patiently. But when you do good and suffer, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example of forbearance, that you should follow his steps. Consider, he says, the unfair treatment that Jesus was subjected to. Verse 22, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously, who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness, by whose stripes you were healed. A lot to live up to there. I also want to make the point, though, that being forbearant, kind of a disclaimer here, doesn't necessarily mean that we need to suffer passively. That is, there may be times when it is appropriate to defend ourselves or others against unfair treatment or pursue justice on our own behalf. But it still must be done with respect and forbearance. The Apostle Paul, in fact, used his Roman citizenship to defend himself against unfair treatment that he was receiving at the hands of local authorities in Jerusalem. Often, though, we will not be able to gain justice. And we just have to accept the fact it's not fair. And some of the unfairness will be very difficult to take. In the years since giving that particular message, I've encountered situations that have seriously tested my ability to practice what I preach. Probably good I gave that message, because I've been in those situations. I think my wife said so, told me once, you know, remember, Bruce, when it isn't fair, you've got to forbear, rather than vent and to her and tell her about the things that were going on at the job or whatever. When it isn't fair, you just must forbear. Okay. It's not easy. Instead of forbearance, I get tempted to go in a different direction. And what is that different direction? What's the flip side of forbearance? What can happen when we don't forbear? Turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 2, and we'll lead up to that. Turns out to be something we've already touched on today. 2 Corinthians 2. The Apostle Paul is instructing the church in Corinth to be forgiving towards one of its members who has been involved in a sin, but had come out of it. 2 Corinthians 2, start in verse 8. Therefore, I urge you to reaffirm your love to him, this person who had been sinning. For to this end, I also wrote that I might put you to the test, whether you are obedient in all things. Now, whom you forgive anything, I also forgive. For if indeed I have forgiven anything, I have forgiven that one for your sakes in the presence of Christ. And here's the key thing, verse 11, lest Satan should take advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices. We need to be aware of the ways in which Satan tries to separate us from God. He has his devices. Turn now to Hebrews 12 and verse 14. Getting closer to the point where that we've already touched on here. Hebrews 12, 14, one of the classes I took years ago at Ambassador College, Mr. Richard Ames gave us a list of what he called the 10 devices of Satan. And number 9 on his list is found in Hebrews 12. And it's what Mr. Ames and many other ministers at that time thought was one of the major reasons people stopped coming to church. It still may be. And it also got me to thinking, Scott Buchanan's going to steal my message today. Hebrews 12, verse 14 tells us, We see it again here. Pursue peace. We've got a different translation that Scott used. Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. Looking carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest, here it is, any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled. Bitterness. Bitterness is one of Satan's devices. Number 9 on Mr. Ames' list. It can be defined as anger and resentment at being treated unfairly. Some synonyms: vindictiveness, holding a grudge. Sometimes instead of pursuing peace, we can allow little seeds of bitterness to grow. And when we allow those things to grow, we're in danger of becoming defiled. Defiled in our relationship to God and the church. I want to consider 2 biblical examples. We could look at David, man after God's own heart. He was patient. He was loyal to the government of God, the government that God set up for Israel, in spite of the terrible way that he was treated by it under the leadership of King Saul. David could have become bitter, and he even had opportunities, we know, to take matters into his own hands. He could have killed Saul, but he didn't. Seemed like a very unfair situation David had been in for a number of years, but he allowed God to resolve it. Other situation, turn to Luke 15, verse 25. Luke 15, verse 25, and consider the older brother in the story of the prodigal son. His irresponsible younger brother has just come home from all his riotous living, squandering his father's assets, or some of them anyway. And his father's throwing a big party for him. Luke 15, verse 25. Now his older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, "Your brother has come, and because he has received him safe and sound, your father has killed the fatted calf." But he, well, the older brother, was angry, became bitter, would not go in. Therefore his father came out and pleaded with him. So he answered and said to his father, "Lo, these many years I've been serving you. I never transgressed your commandment at any time. And yet you never gave me a young goat that I might be merry with my friends. How fair is that? But as soon as a son of yours came," and notice he says, "your son." He didn't say my brother. He had an attitude. Let's see. "But as soon as this son of yours came, who has devoured your livelihood with harlots, you killed the fatted calf for him." That's not fair. Verse 31, he said to him, "Son, you're always with me, and all that I have is yours. It was right that we should make merry and be glad for your brother. Be glad, for your brother was dead and is alive again, and was lost and is found." God often views fairness from a different perspective than we do. I have a book, actually I have it at school where I'm teaching at the moment. I've mentioned it before, I think, in a message. It's 1001 Things Every Teen Should Know Before They Leave Home, or Else They'll Come Back. Long title. But when I remember, I try to start class by reading a few of those, and we're not going to get through all 1001, but I read through a few of them. I pick out some of the good ones there and read them to the kids. And number 13 on the list, says, life isn't fair, and be grateful for it. Sometimes we do lose perspective. Because if life on this earth was really fair, those of us here would not be living as well as we do. If life was really fair, we'd probably be living closer to 80 or 90 or 95% of the world. And they don't live like we do. So God has a different perspective on what's fair. Let's turn to Ephesians 4, 1. Ephesians 4, 1. One of the antidotes to bitterness is, of course, a forbearing attitude. And we'll notice the character traits that Paul describes. Ephesians 4, 1, he describes traits that can help us define and recognize forbearance. Ephesians 4, verse 1, I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling with which you are called, with all lowliness and gentleness. He's talking again about humility. With long suffering, bearing with one another in love, in endeavoring, working hard to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called in one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God, and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in all. Another thing to point out here, notice the emphasis on oneness and unity. Forbearance promotes unity. It involves the fruits of the Spirit, the long-suffering, the patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, self-control. Bitterness leads to division. It certainly did and was causing division in the family of the prodigal son. Bitterness involves the works of the flesh, the envy, the anger, the jealousy, contentiousness, selfishness, selfish ambition. Skip ahead here in Ephesians. Skip ahead to verse 17. Ephesians 4:17. This I say, therefore, and testify in the Lord, that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk, in the futility of their mind, having their understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God, because of the ignorance that is in them. They don't know any better. Because of the blindness of their heart, who being past feeling, have given themselves over to lewdness, to work all uncleanness with greediness. The Good News Bible, it reads, they've lost all feeling of shame. They give themselves over to vice and do all sorts of indecent things without restraint. But you have not so learned Christ. We know better. We're not blind of heart. Our minds have been opened. We should be acting and reacting very differently than most of the world around us. Verse 21. If indeed you have heard him and have been taught by him, as the truth is in Jesus, that you put off concerning your former conduct the old man which grows corrupt according to deceitful lusts, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that you put on the new man which was created according to God in true righteousness and holiness. Therefore, putting away lying, let each one of you speak truth with his neighbor. For we are members of one another. We want to be unified. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sin go down on your wrath. Over in the Good News Bible, again, it reads, if you become angry, don't let your anger lead you into sin. And do not stay angry all day. New Living Translation says, don't sin by letting anger control you. Verse 27, back to the New King James, which I've been using most of the time here. Nor give place to the devil. Don't give in to the devices of Satan. Verse 28, let him who stole steal no longer, but rather let him labor, working with his hands what is good, that he may have something to give him who has need. God wants us to be givers. 29, let no corrupt word proceed from your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Verse 31, here it is again. Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. And be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God in Christ forgave you. You read this, and it makes you wonder sometime just how much division in the church could have been avoided, how much more unified the various congregations could be if only we'd been a little more forbearing at times, if only we hadn't let that root of bitterness spring up. As Scott mentioned, once a seed of bitterness gets started, once it starts growing, it puts down roots. And just like a plant, it's difficult to pull up a plant when it's got good roots set in. The mid-1990s, we faced doctrinal issues in the church. And there was division among those who thought Sabbath commandment was still valid and in effect, and those who thought it wasn't. And we kind of understood that division. But some of the division that's happened since, it hasn't been over doctrine. And sometimes you wonder if it's been because of attitudes and perhaps even bitterness. Bitterness, it seems, is often the result of being offended. Maybe somebody says something, the wrong thing at the wrong time. Maybe at church, somebody in authority position makes a decision that goes contrary to what somebody else thinks should be done. Maybe they're just a simple misunderstanding. So it's very important that we strive not to be easily offended. Strive to be unoffendable. Chose forbearance. If at all possible, let's try to overlook offenses, ignore them, and let them die. Don't necessarily go to your brother if he offends you. Sometimes you can just let it go. Apparently, there have been times where you feel like, well, I got to go to my brother. I got to go tell him off. No, that's not the way you do it. Sometimes the go to your brother principle gets misapplied. It gets abused. Doesn't mean that we don't do it when it's appropriate. We don't want to stifle communication. We want to do it in the right way. There's a misunderstanding that can be resolved by constructive, caring communication without raising your voice or your blood pressure. Then yes, by all means, we do that. We go to our brother. Otherwise, if we can, sometimes it's better to overlook the offense. A few years ago, I gave a sermonette in an outlying area, and it happened to be an identical one that I'd given in Salem. And it was well received in Salem, and I'd given it a few years earlier than when I went to this outlying area. But after giving it in that area, one of the members pulled me aside after services, and he wanted to talk to me about it. I think maybe he thought it was a go-to-your-brother situation. But he wasn't very nice about it. And in fact, he said, as close as I can remember, your message was pathetic. Your examples were dated. They had no relevance to today and no relevance to our congregation. You did not consider your audience. It was a waste of our time. Actually, he might have said it was a complete waste of our time. Of course, immediately I got defensive. I thought, well, the people in Salem really liked it, and, you know. I didn't say that. I think I was thinking, when it isn't fair, you still got to forbear, you know. And I calmed down, and I said something like, well, thanks for your input. I'll try to do better next time. Kind of surprised myself. But I got to thinking later that there must have been something else bothering him. Not to use that tone of voice with me. And so it was good. I just let it go. Although I did get thinking a little more about it, too, and thought more about what he actually said. And I had to admit, his criticism of my sermonette was, wow, it was fair. It was accurate. My message was dated. Yeah, it worked a couple of years before in Salem, but wow, no, it wasn't relevant. It didn't fit their congregation. So I guess there are times where it's good to forbear when it is fair. Sometimes then it's even harder to take. Because, wow, he was right. Wasn't very tactful, but he was right. However, he did stop coming to church a few years later and talking with some of the other members there and asking about him. Apparently he'd been offended by some issue. It wasn't my sermonette. It was something before then. That was good to hear. But it had been festering him with him for quite some time. And so I kind of wondered, well, is that a result of bitterness, perhaps? So one antidote to bitterness is don't be easily offended. Forbear the offense. I've actually got three antidotes here that I'll mention. So that was the first one. Don't be easily offended. A second antidote to bitterness, don't stop giving. And I'm not just talking about tithes and offerings. I'm talking about our faithful, balanced service to the church and to our church family. Continue to give as you are able, of your time, your energy, and your prayers. Don't stop praying for people. Maybe especially if you think they've offended you. Pray for people. Continue to stay involved with the activities of the church. And do it cheerfully. Paul reminds us that God loves a cheerful giver. Luke writes, give and it'll be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together and running over. For with the same measure that you use, it will be measured back to you. That was Luke 6:38. Let's also consider the workplace. Maybe we've been treated unfairly at work. Anybody ever been treated unfairly at work? Maybe we've been passed over for a promotion or a pay raise. Maybe the position we were hoping for was given to a marginally competent or maybe incompetent coworker. I've seen that happen a few times. But we can't let that stop us from being a good employee and to cheerfully give our best on the job. Mr. Armstrong used to remind us that there were two ways of operating in this world. Two ways of operating. The way of give and the way of get. The way of give still works. When I went to Ambassador College years ago, it was a great life-changing experience for me. In many ways, it was a nice contrast to the 4 or 5 years that I spent at a regular state-run college. Learned a lot at Ambassador College. I've got great memories there. Maybe it was because I started as a 33-year-old freshman and had gone to a non-religious college, but I remember the dean of students at that time, he had He had a little talk with me in his office, and he talked to me personally. I don't know if he thought I was going to be a problem or something, but he said, don't expect things to be perfect here. Because I went in, I was kind of enthusiastic at the time, and I was thinking at that time, you know, yeah, I went through a regular college from when I was 18 to 22, and boy, looking back at that, wow, I wish I could have done things differently. And well, things were very different there. Things weren't done the way they should have been. And now I'm coming to a school where I can do things differently, and things are going to be better here. This is going to be a lot better than that regular college. And I think maybe he thought, you know, that maybe that's what Bruce is expecting here. But no, it's not going to be that way. It's not going to be perfect. And he was right. Things weren't perfect at Ambassador College. In fact, there were some things that seemed irritatingly illogical and unfair. I had to take typing class. Well, they'd call it keyboarding. Well, I took typing class in high school. I got up to about, I don't know, 35 words a minute. Well, I got there, and unless you can type 40 words a minute, you have to take typing class. I didn't come to Ambassador College to take typing class. Well, you've got to, if you don't want to take typing class, type 40 words a minute. I was close, so I had to take typing class. And I grumbled, and I think I was in there for 3 or 4 weeks maybe before I finally got up to 40 words a minute and didn't make too many mistakes. And I got through it, and I kind of grumbled about it. But there were people in that class, they had a good attitude about it. One of the guys, he was an older student. He was 1 year younger, but this was actually his second year in the class. Big Joe, 6'7" and 260 or 70 pounds. He was an ex-professional football player. Big, gnarly hands, you know, and it was difficult for him. And he did graduate. I don't know how long it took him to get through typing class, but he did. And then there's skill set issues. Like the year that they appointed the president of the dance club was a student who didn't dance. He didn't know how to dance. There was, forced employment, I guess you'd say. I went down there, and I paid my tuition for the whole year, and I was ready to study. And I got a note after a week or so down there, and I got called into the Susie and Linda might remember, Joe Slevin, I forget what his position was. He was some director of student employment or something, I guess. And he called me in, and we noticed you don't have a job. Well, no. Am I supposed to? Well, all the students here have a job on campus. They do? Well, I don't need a job. I've been working in public schools up in Oregon for 10 years, and I've saved up my money, and I've already paid my tuition. In fact, if you want, I can pay next year's and the year following right now. Well, that's not the way we operate here. You still need a job. And, oh, you said you're in education? Yeah. I was a teacher. Oh, well, yeah, we've got Imperial School and got teachers over there. Yeah, okay. And so I got assigned to the custodial crew. And I worked nights and emptied waste baskets and cleaned bathrooms. And I was not allowed to live off campus. I was single at the time, so I had to live in the dorm. And here I'm 33 years old, and I'm in a dorm with 18-year-old freshmen. And actually, that worked out pretty well, living in the dorm, because I got to eat at the food service building there. Ambassador College had good food, and so that worked out well. And actually, some of the stories with some of the roommates there, but yeah, okay, one of them. We had a little guy from the Philippines, must have been about 5'6", maybe 5'4", I don't know, Ezra, and we had a tall guy from Indiana, Joe, 6'4", basketball player. The two of them were good buddies. They got to be good buddies. But they were always, I don't know, if they wanted to prank the old guy or what it was, But I worked like clockwork. I'd go to work, and in the evenings, I'd come back about every time. I think it was like 9 o'clock, and they noticed this. Man, Bruce is always, he comes back into his bedroom 9 o'clock every night. Boom, boom, boom. And so evidently, they got this idea. They're gonna hide in my, I don't know what you call it, sort of a little cabinet we had next to our beds in the dorm. We had these drawers kind of on the floor, and then up a little bit from the drawers, there was this kind of small cabinet you could hang shirts up in. It wasn't very big, maybe this high and this wide, and they got the idea, let's go in there and let's hide. And when he comes home and he opens up to put his shirts away, we'll jump out at him and scare him. And they did. But I kind of thought the joke was on them. That particular night, I had to work an extra hour. And I thought, in fact, I still laugh about it, thinking of little Ezra and Big Joe scrunched up, curled all up, and waiting there for an hour for me so they could come. They enjoyed it, though. And they thought it was great. But I thought it was funny, too. Lost my place here. Oh, then the inane test questions. Yeah. You know, you're taking a Bible class, and one of the questions on the test, what was the brand of tire that Mr. Armstrong used when he had to change his flat when he was on his way from Salem to Seattle before he... Really? Seriously? And I think I wrote something in. I said, this is really an inane question. Who thinks up these? And the dean of students called me in later on that. And I talked to some of the students. I think maybe I talked to Ezra and Joe after the test. They were in the same class. And I said, can you believe those questions? And they said, yeah. And how do they expect us to know the tire? And they said, well, Bruce, didn't you read the booklet? We were supposed to read one of the church booklets at the time, you know. And, well, yeah. Well, the booklet said what tire. Well, why would you pay attention to that, you know? And what's that got to do with my salvation? I said, in fact, I don't even remember that on the booklet. And I went back and I looked through the booklet. I couldn't find anything about him changing the tire. And I told that to Ezra and Joe, or I think it was them. And they got out their booklet and they went through and they found the page. And see, there it is. Well, wait a minute. This isn't fair. I got a different version of the same booklet. I must have gotten the updated version when they thought it was a bad story, and so they took it out. And I'm the one that got the question wrong for it. It wasn't fair. Through it all, yeah, my attitude was tested. I noticed the students that I admired most down there, though, they just shrugged off those little injustices. They'd sigh, and they'd remind themselves, and they'd say, and I could hear it frequently, they'd say, the way of give still works, and Romans 8:28 is still in the Bible. And that's the third antidote to bitterness. Romans 8:28 is still in the Bible. So we'll go there. Romans 8:28. Some of you probably got it memorized. And we know all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. And yes, things did work to good, as illogical sometimes as they seemed, or most of them worked to good. Some were just illogical and unfair, but you know, Ambassador College wasn't completely perfect, of course. And One of my math teacher colleagues in the district got a teaching job at a school in West Salem. She liked the job. She could see herself teaching there for a long time. So she and her husband bought a house within easy walking distance to the school. She taught there for a number of years. Good teacher. And I'd worked with her on some committees, and her kids went there too. Then about 6 or 7 years ago, kind of out of the blue, the district said, you're not teaching here. They've got a need over on the other side of town. They need a math teacher over there, and you are going over there. And I thought, wow, how can they do that? That's not fair. She interviewed with a school over in West Salem, and so she's got to go across the bridge every day and then back. And of course, she didn't take it any better than I did. It wasn't me, so I mean, I could say, oh, wow, that's not fair. I'm glad it's you and not me. No, I didn't really. Well, I was glad it wasn't me. But she didn't take it too well. And the stories that I'd heard, yeah, she'd teach just to the contract, which a lot of teachers don't do. They're in early. They stay late. They take stuff home. And she decided that 1 year, I'm working to the contract. This is the way the district's going to treat me. I'm going to show up right when I'm supposed to. I'm going to go home right when the kids leave or shortly afterwards. And I'm not taking anything home. And, of course, you don't do as well as a teacher when you teach like that. And she didn't. I even heard stories that she'd show up with her in her bathrobe to teach sometimes. That she had an attitude. And the next year there was an opening at her old school for a math teacher. And so she applied for it, and she got it, and she went over there. And well, good. Okay, good. She can go back to what she was doing. That same year, in the spring, my supervisor came into me and said, Bruce, we've got your schedule for next year. You're going to be teaching, and he mentioned two classes. Well, that's good. Usually I have to teach three different subjects, and what are they? And he mentioned, I like teaching those classes. And those are the only ones I'm going to have to teach. Oh, that is great. That's stupendous. And so I was really looking forward to that next year. And then he came in the next day and he said, oh, Bruce, I got to talk with you again. Yeah, what is it? Well, this school, turns out it was the same school where this other lady was. They've got an enrollment increase. Our enrollment is down. And you're being transferred to that school. And I said, you're kidding. I really thought he was kidding, but he wasn't. And I said, well, do they realize that one of my daughters was here. She's here on an in-district transfer. And this is going to cause some problems. I mean, I have to drive her here to this school. And then so I have to then go to the other school. And wait a minute. Don't I have seniority? I mean, this is my 30th year at the school. Shouldn't they be giving me a gold watch or something, 30 years? And I'm sorry, Bruce, I'm just the messenger. And that did not seem fair. In fact, it was so bad, I didn't tell my wife about it for about 3 weeks. When it isn't fair, you must still forbear. You must still forbear. And I made up my mind, okay, I'll do it. And it was a lot of work. And maybe this better be the last year I teach. And if this is the last year I'm going to teach, I better do it well. And I better have a good attitude. And I better not do it like the other gal did. And so I did. And I went in, I put in a lot of work, and I did my best. And I tried to smile. It was kind of a fake smile a lot of times. I tried to have a good attitude. But apparently I fooled a lot of people. They thought I was having a good time there, and they were impressed with my attitude. And I shouldn't say I fooled. I think sometimes when you do act happier, you are happier. And went through it, and it did work out for the best. I got a lot of, I came back with a lot of friends. I'm glad I went to that school. It did push me into retirement 1 year earlier than I'd planned. Not 1 year, I guess 2 years or 3 years earlier than I'd planned. And that was a good thing. That was a real good thing. Things do work together for good. And it certainly did there. Satan's got his devices. Bitterness is one of them. The manner in which we respond to the injustices that we experience in life, not only a test of our Christian character, but it affects our future. Will we forbear or become bitter? Let's not let that root of bitterness separate us from our crown. Can you remember the three antidotes? When it isn't fair, we must still forbear. The way of give still works, and Romans 3:28 is still in the Bible. Now, maybe things won't always work out immediately in our physical lives now, but we serve a God of justice, and God will eventually correct all injustices. Some of the corrections may not even come in this lifetime, but they will come. When it isn't fair, we must still forbear. The way of give still works, and Romans 8:28 is still in the Bible.